Full Story is supported by Telstra. Big ambitions need the right partner, and that's where Telstra comes in. Telstra works with enterprise and government organisations across Australia to help them build, connect, and grow at scale. They support real outcomes, from secure business growth to connecting schools to networks that help keep communities safe. Telstra is a long-term partner for organisations with complex needs and big plans. Together builds better, wherever they go. For enterprise-sized solutions, partner with Telstra.
Hi, Dan. It's good to see you again.
Hey, Regid.
Look, Dan, you spent a lot of time in South Australia cutting your teeth, cutting your journalistic teeth and growing up there. And now you've gone back this weekend to get a sense of the mood amongst voters. What were they telling you?
Yeah, I did. I spent the first 28 years of my life living in Adelaide. And it was interesting to have returned there over the time that I've been in Canberra. But it was interesting going back as a journalist and covering it in the context of a state election where you're really assessing how the state is doing. And I think my observations feed into one of the themes of this election. I mean, for the time that I was growing up in South Australia, it was a place that people wanted to leave for job opportunities, for lifestyle reasons. It was considered a boring place for a lot of the time that I grew up. And I think it's really interesting because a lot of that perception, both within Adelaide and also externally, has changed. Adelaide's, I think, is having a bit of a moment. And it's something that the Premier, Peter Malinauskas, is really trying to put front and centre in his election pitch. I was at the election leaders debate last Friday, and he used this phrase a couple of times, that Adelaide is on fire, that it's kind of firing on all cylinders from an economic front, but it's really thriving. It's bringing lots of events to South Australia. And I think that sentiment is shared certainly by a section of the population, but there's also another group within South Australia who thinks the state is on fire for a very different set of reasons, and those are the people that think the state is heading in the wrong direction and potentially are the types of people that are going to vote for One Nation on Saturday. And that really is the two themes that I think have emerged. This one sense of this very strong, powerful, stable, popular Labor government, but also this well of discontent that is manifesting around One Nation. And it is the real story is can we see One Nation turn polling numbers into seats in Parliament?
That really brings me to my next question, because normally we wouldn't be watching a state election perhaps as closely as we would this one, but this one is really being seen as some sort of perhaps pattern that might emerge federally.
Yeah, it is seen as the first litmus test for the capacity for One Nation to be able to turn what has been quite extraordinary polling numbers really since the federal election last May. Can they translate what is driving that discontent, that frustration, that grievance? Can they turn it into votes on election day? And the South Australian election is going to be the first opportunity to see whether that's possible. Obviously, there's the Farrer federal by-election in May, but this South Australian state election is the first chance to see whether One Nation can harness support when it matters. And, you know, we're seeing the polls that are being conducted in South Australia. There was a series of polls done through February, and they all showed the One Nation vote in the 20s, ahead of the Liberals in all of those. So if that is replicated on election day, it could mean very, very bad things for the Liberal Party, but it could also mean that One Nation picks up seats and we start to see them becoming not just a kind of noisy force, but someone who's in Parliament and is potentially able to dictate and shape the agenda from within Parliament. So there are a number of storylines here that have federal connotations. One of them is One Nation and can they turn poll numbers into seats in Parliament?
You spent time with One Nation voters, people who were shifting their vote from major parties. What were they telling you about why?
They want change. If I had a counter of the number of times a word had been repeated by a voter, change would have been the number one. And I think it's whether that was somebody who had previously voted for the Liberal Party or somebody who'd previously voted for the Labor Party. The thing that unified them and was dragging them towards One Nation was this sense that the political establishment, and they kind of lump Labor and the Liberal Party in together, and One Nation is caught on to that, and they refer to both major parties as the uni party, that there is nothing that can differentiate one from the other. And what the people who are being attracted to One Nation are saying is that the establishment has just not worked for them. The system has just not worked for them, and they really want to use a kind of crass phrase, just blow it up. And they see One Nation, as I spoke to a voter outside a polling place in Elizabeth, which is a very working class area of Adelaide's northern suburbs. And he was very, very happy to talk, a former Labor voter, local council worker, said he'd been a working man all his life. And he just says, he looked me in the eye, he says, Pauline's got the answers, mate.
I thought it was fascinating that you also referenced voters' reaction when it was put to them that One Nation didn't have policies to deal with these issues.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, so that there's the sense from the voters that the major parties don't have the answers, and that Pauline Hanson at a federal level and Corey Bernardi, who's the leader at the state level, do have the answers. But you're right, when you look at their policy offerings and One Nation, both federally and a state level, have websites that detail their policies, it's extraordinarily thin. They're not really policies. They're essentially just motherhood statements. But they're resonating with these voters. And it's almost a sense of, and whether they know deep down that the idea of One Nation's policy for energy, for instance, is just getting rid of net zero and getting out of the Paris Agreement. That isn't an energy policy. That's just a motherhood statement. But there's a sense almost that, and we've seen this in the UK and the US, is just when you have political leaders that are saying things that certain types of voters feel like they're being heard almost, that I know the policy, if it was implemented, doesn't really mean anything, but you are echoing, you're giving voice to this grievance that I have, and almost that is enough. That whether or not that can be practically implemented is almost beside the point, because I feel as though these major parties that have been in control for so long don't listen to me, whereas you are listening to me. And it's a very powerful motivation, I think, for certain types of voters who feel like the system hasn't worked, that someone within the political realm is speaking for them. Now, there is a whole wave of contradictions within One Nation, and, you know, they're presenting themselves as the party of the working people, and yet they're supported by people such as Gina Rinehart. But there is something that is resonating with voters here, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it plays out on Saturday.
There's almost a validating of feelings. I just want to ask a bit more about that before we get on to Malinauskas. It is essentially a far-right party, and there's been some racist rhetoric. I mean, do voters, are they turned off over that, or do they just ignore it? How do they reconcile that?
It's really interesting to see that one of the things that has meant Pauline Hanson has always been on the fringes of the political spectrum and hasn't been able to crack into the mainstream is in large part, I think, due to that, the very overt racism that has flowed through her politics. Now, individual voters will have different reasons, but I don't get the sense that people at this stage feel ashamed to support One Nation, to put on that orange top, to take the One Nation How to Vote card. Now, whether or not that means that they feel more comfortable with what Pauline Hanson has said previously and still does about immigration, or whether they just are willing to look past that because of what they believe in on other issues or just the scale of discontent towards the major parties, I don't know. But I think it is true, and I think we'll potentially see this at the Farah by-election, that One Nation as a brand has become or is more palatable now than what it has been even in the very recent past. And I think that is a really interesting change in the dynamic of our politics in Australia. And I think it's something that we should, I think there is cause for concern in part of that. It's legitimised some of Pauline Hanson's politics, but how the major parties reconcile with that will be fascinating.
Let's turn to Peter Malinauskas, the Premier, because it's fascinating to look at what major parties can do to counter One Nation. He's very popular. He's tipped to win, which makes this conversation even more fascinating. And analysts have talked about him as a rare talent. Tony Barry from Back to Back Barry's described him as a political athlete. Mm. Can you explain what his secret is?
It's a really good question, and I'll get to the way that he deals with One Nation in a second, because I think that is fascinating. But I think as a political athlete, to use Tony Barry's phrase, he's been training for this all his life. He was a union leader. He was mentored by Don Farrell, who is a very significant person within the right of the Labor Party. He's almost kind of like a political machine that has been built and now is being put out there and is showing all the skills that he's developed. In terms of the reason that I think he's so popular in South Australia is, and I think this goes back to the COVID pandemic when he was the opposition leader, is it was a time where the Liberal government were in power at a state level. The business community, the private sector, the people who traditionally were Liberal supporters felt really alienated by the state government. You'll recall that time of heavy restrictions and so on. At that point, Peter Malinauskas made a concerted decision to ingratiate himself with the business community to make them feel as though they had a supporter in him in the private sector. And what he was able to do, if you think of the private sector as kind of a conduit to Liberal voters, is he was able to win over that community and really more or less make Liberals feel comfortable to vote for him. I mean, I'm from South Australia. The types of people who I've met or went to school with who would have never in any circumstance voted for a Labor Premier feel comfortable to vote for Malinauskas. So what he's been able to do by running a kind of pro-business but also pro-worker agenda is he's been able to occupy a huge part of the political middle ground in South Australia. And at the same time, the Liberals have been pushed further to the right. They no longer really have the support of the business community, so they don't really have a natural constituency. And as they go further to the right and being pulled further to the right by One Nation, Malinauskas occupies more or less the entire real estate that allows you to win elections. And in South Australia, there really isn't a major threat on his left flank from the Greens or the Teal independents. So he just occupies this enormous part of where you need to be to win elections.
New national polling is showing, though, that Labor is losing support to One Nation. Mm. So how is he countering that threat?
The way that he talks about One Nation is really interesting, and I think it almost provides a template for how Anthony Albanese can deal with it at a federal level against Hanson and Barnaby Joyce. So there's kind of two elements in the way that he talks about it. One is he's very open about saying that the One Nation voters are driven by legitimate grievances, anxieties, frustrations, this sense that, and he said it at the leaders' debate, this sense of lost opportunity, that the economic reality of certainly places like South Australia, where people have been left behind, and that's almost manifested most acutely in the housing crisis. And it's because of the problems in the housing crisis, for instance, that people feel disillusioned with the establishment and then turn to somewhere radical for the solution. So his strategy is to acknowledge that problem, but then say, in order to confront One Nation, we have to confront the source of the grievance, and that is what we're going to do with housing policies, for instance. I think he's being quite clever in the way that he's drawing a distinction between One Nation as a party and One Nation voters, because I think there is a real risk for both of the major parties if they are seen talking down or alienating One Nation voters. So Malinauskas is trying to draw that distinction, acknowledge the grievance, set out policies to address solutions to it, and also point out the fact that whilst One Nation is very good at pointing out problems, they themselves don't have the policies to fix them.
We'll be right back. Just briefly, we do need to talk about the Liberals. You've mentioned them. They're under a huge threat from One Nation, and you've described their polling as catastrophic. What do you think is going to happen here in this election?
Well, the worst case scenario, and this is a scenario that some Liberals think could come to pass, is that they are reduced to maybe half a dozen seats, potentially less, in the type of result that really only the only kind of comparable result in recent times was at the 2021 West Australian election during COVID, extraordinary times where the Liberals there were reduced to just a couple of seats in the lower house. But the Liberals here have had just all sorts of turmoil. Ashton Hearn, who's the opposition leader at the moment, she's a 35-year-old mother who's very accomplished, a very strong performer. She's also the fourth leader that the state Liberals have had in 4 years. She took on the role just roughly 100 days before the election, really because the party was presented with polling that showed if we don't change now, we might lose everything. So she's just been given the task of, I think, saving the furniture, which includes her own seat, which is a seat that has never left Liberal hands. So, look, I think if on election day on Saturday, if the Liberals get close, so there are 47 seats in the lower house, if the Liberals have 10 of them when on Saturday night, I think they'll be happy. The worst case scenario is they might win one or two. I think the sense is, you know, maybe five or six, but it's going to be a very long period in opposition for them and a very long period of this kind of, and we've seen it at a federal level, this soul searching of where is the future of our party?
It says something that we've not even spent a lot of time talking about them in terms of their relevance. Very briefly, before we go, I have to ask, I mean, this state election is being seen as a microcosm of national politics, but is that unfair? Are we potentially going to read far too much into what is essentially a state election in a very distinct part of Australia?
I think there's always risks in trying to draw national implications from state elections or from by-elections. It's not going to stop us from doing it because that's what we as political observers and political journalists like to do. I think there are, as I said, narratives, there are national narratives playing out locally. But I think if we see One Nation, now I think it's worth mentioning in terms of what is the expectations for One Nation. I think they're expected to win two upper house seats. So that's Corey Bernardi and Carlos Caremba, who's the state president. People would be surprised if they picked up a lower house seat. But if they do, if they pick up one, two or three, then I think that'll be really interesting. And so I think we'll be talking about this election for days after the result plays out. But I think there should be some caution about thinking what happens here will be replicated across the country.
Well, Dan, I know what you're going to be doing this weekend. You'll be watching the results flow in. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That That was Chief Political Correspondent Dan Jervis-Bardi. This episode was produced by Karishma Luthria, sound design and mixing by Daniel Simo. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story wherever you listen to podcasts, including on Spotify. I'm Regid Ahmed. See you soon.